Back again on the April 2015 edition of the Mike Moore Show on Dakota Country 1210.
KOKK.
Performance Radio News Director Zach Nelson, along with Beadle County State's Attorney Mike Moore. And Mike, as we get into the next segment here, we'll talk about a very large vandalism spree that took place recently here in Huron. Huron Police Department arresting four juveniles, and this enters into a number of different facets and caveat of the legal system. Obviously, juveniles, so we're not talking about names here. You pretty much have gender and age, and I think the age range, if I remember right, from the police department was 15 to 17 years old. And I know, just looking at our Facebook page and the comments that were posted, so many people angry, rightfully angry at what's taken place. But the recourses, legally here, Mike, I don't even know where to start. I know one of the big questions was with the amount of damage done, which the last time I had heard was approximately $80,000. I don't know if that number has gone up, or if you've seen anything different than you can release. And again, I stress release, because this is still an active case and it's moving through the system, and we don't want to do anything to jeopardize any sort of restitution for these approximately 120, maybe more, people who were victimized. But what kind of recourse is there, Mike, from a restitution standpoint, when you've got people that, the minimum wage is only $7.50, assuming the individuals were to have jobs, where do the victims get any kind of financial recourse from something like this as it moves through?
That's probably the most difficult question that I'll be asked through this process is, when are we going to see our money? And unfortunately, the answer to that question is, I don't know. I mean, and whether they will or ever see their money back from this is still up in the air. I mean, not that we won't do our best to run these people through the system, get them convicted, and get them ordered to pay restitution, but the laws in our state and the fact that they're juveniles really complicate that, and the extent of the damage. I mean, if you're talking $80,000+ of damage, and we're talking juveniles, it's just going to be a real hard problem for us to actually collect that $80,000 back. It's going to be very difficult, and it's really hard for me to talk to the victims, because that's my answer, is I just don't, there's not much I can do, that there's not a lot of tools I have that to get their money back, and we'll do the best we can. It's just the reality of the situation.
A lot of people are saying, well, go after the parents, go after the parents. How much responsibility do parents of juveniles who get in trouble like this actually have to the situation? I mean, how much can you actually go back on them and penalize them for the actions of their children?
Well, the parents are responsible to a certain extent in a limited dollar amount. So it would be, I think it's $1,500 or $2,000, but is it per incident? Which might be per person that's been damaged, or would it be as a whole, because it was a crime spree where they acted together? Because they'll be charged as one large event for all 120 people that were injured. I'm not going to charge them with 120 different counts. So that'll be a question that'll have to be answered through the process. And if the victims want to do that, they will have the opportunity to do that, but the victims have rights to. The victims will know who these individuals are. They're allowed to come to court and view it, even though it's a closed proceeding for the general public. But the victims, under our laws, are allowed to come and see what happens in court. Just to talk about that, on Monday night, the 27th of April at 5:30, we're going to have a large meeting for all the victims. We're going to invite all the victims to come to the courthouse. We're going to have it up in the on the third floor in the courtroom and talk to all the victims, as many as we can get there, because there are so many. It's hard for us to reach out to everybody individually. So if I can get a large group there together on Monday evening, I'm going to talk to them about what their rights are, what we're doing, what information we can and cannot share with them, tell them when these court appearances are if they want to come. And just try to give them some kind of sense that we're thinking about them, and let them understand what the process is going to be as we move forward.
Have you ever had to do anything like that before because of the scale of what's happened?
this will be the first time that I've done something like this, because there is so many people. And there was some incidents to be in the past where we had these problems where we tried to work through it individually. And based on our learning about those and now having this incident, I think it's we just thought this is the best thing to do, is let's have one big meeting. And the reason we're doing it Monday night is because their next appearance is on Tuesday, the 28th. So we're going to try to get as many people in. We're going to have to get information from them. We're going to need information on restitution amounts, what damage was done, you know, evidence of photographs if the police don't have it. We're going to need to make sure that we have all that covered so we can go forward and convict the, and hold the people responsible that have done this. But also we want to inform them of what's going on. So doing that once is a lot better for us and more efficient use of our time than trying to do that 120 different times.
Has this at all affected operations in the office when you look at the sheer volume of information and cases that you have? I mean, has it been taxing? I guess to compare it to anything, I guess I would try to, you know, maybe compare it to what happened in 2009 when you had all of the homicide cases in town. Those are high intensive workload cases. Now you've got, you know, a vandalism is a window shot out, but when you multiply that by 120 plus, that looks like a big workload.
It is. It's a lot of workload, a lot of staff time. We have to put that information together. We have to inform these, you know, try to keep the victims informed, tell them what's going on. We have to document each case so we know that we can prove it at trial. We're going to have to go over all 120 incidents, make sure what evidence do we have to support this incident? Can we prove that they committed this incident? Things like that. So we're going to have to go through all of those individually. So even though you see four defendants and you think it's one case, it's actually about 120 cases in one incident. And we do probably about 1,000 cases a year. So in this one incident, we're doing 120 cases. And I think that's what it's comparable to. So we're doing 10% of our work on this incident in a week's time, and trying to put that all together so we can appear in court and move this as quickly as possible. And there's some things that maybe we'll talk about later in the show about Senate Bill 73, the new juvenile justice reform. Why I think it's important to talk about that is because the game would be a little bit different had this happened after July 1st of this year. What we could do would be a lot more limited after July 1st, and that's something that I don't think people really knew about when they passed that so overwhelmingly. I'm not criticizing it. I think it's a good idea, but when you actually apply it in practical terms, you know, it might not be the best result that everybody was hoping for. And if we have time, we can talk about some of the specifics of that as we go through and say, here's what would be different after July 1st.
We will do that in the next segment. I've got one more question I want to ask you before we go to break. And it kind of sits in line with that. One of the other comments that was very popular on our social media here at the radio station was they want to see these kids put in jail forever. Realistically, Mike, that can't happen. But briefly, you know, they turn 18 and this is water under the bridge?
Yes. I mean, to a certain extent, yes. That's true. And it even becomes more apparent, as we talked about going forward. But, you know, you can keep a juvenile on probation until they're 21. So 18 isn't a magic number where you get automatically off probation. So we can keep them on until they're 21, but after they're 21, we can't keep them on anymore. And so you basically, in the best case scenario, and I'm telling you that's probably not the scenario that's going to happen, but the 17-year-old, you have 4 years to collect $80,000. I mean, that's a lot of money in 4 years. And that's the best case scenario, because the reality is they'll be on probation or supervision a lot shorter time than that.
And then say when the oldest, the 17-year-old, hits that 21 mark, they're not obligated to repay whatever restitution may be left?
Not under the juvenile court proceeding. That proceeding will be over. There are mechanisms in the law that allow a victim to turn a criminal order of restitution into a civil judgment. And that might be done by these victims, and that was something that we'll talk about with the victims on Monday night. But the us having the ability to do anything with these individuals after they turn 21 is zero. We have no ability to do anything with them.
Very interesting. We will take a break here and return. We will continue with this as you're listening to the Mike Moore Show on Dakota Country 1210.
KOKK.